LibertyNation.com does not endorse candidates, campaigns, or legislation, and this presentation is no endorsement. On Wednesday, December 1st, the Supreme Court will hear Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health. The court took the case to resolve whether all pre-viability prohibitions on elective abortions are unconstitutional. Quite simply, it's the biggest abortion case in a generation and could overturn Roe v. Wade. Join us as we examine the case and its likely outcome on this uprising with expert guest Joseph Della Penna, law professor and author of Dispelling the Myths of Abortion History.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising with Scott Cosenza.
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15.
If we're in high school, I'd take you behind the gym and beat the hell out of him.
His Twitter account should be suspended.
Right. You want to go to work? Go take the job as an essential worker. Do it tomorrow.
I just don't even know why there aren't uprisings all over the country, and maybe there will be when people realize.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
I'm high as a kite in my garage, and I can see through these guys.
Welcome to the Uprising Podcast. You know, when I was your student, and I'm sure this was true for most, if not all, your students, you asked us to call you Joe and not stand on formality. But if I lapse into just calling you professor, that's not a choice for formality, but just what's comfortable. So
I understood. I said to my students, and I still say it to my students, my name is Joe. It's not professor. But if you're not comfortable, then you say what's comfortable for you.
So I'll tell everybody that you were my law professor. I had you for transnational litigation, by the way. Yeah. And you were a good professor, and you were a kind professor. And those two things.
Not everyone felt that way about me.
Well, I remember quite distinctly that you hosted us at your home for a class.
Yes.
Which was very much warm and welcome.
Yes. And I think unique at Villanova anyway.
It was in my experience. Yeah. It was for sure where you were for, if I recall from your bio, 2 months or 3 months shy of 40 years as a law professor.
Yeah.
And you've taught
40 years
in China, really around the world. And yes, you are well published in both what we're going to talk about today, which is abortion and the history of abortion law in the United States, and also notably water rights and the law, international law of water rights. So, Professor Della Penna, when I just want to take a trip back in time to 1973 when Roe v. Wade was decided. Were you a lawyer and were you teaching at that point? Or what was your, do you recall when it came out? What was the reaction?
Yeah, the answer is yes to both, actually. When Roe v. Wade itself was decided, I had been teaching for 3 years at Willamette University, which is in Salem, Oregon, teaching law. And I had taught legal writing at George Washington University before that. I don't know if you want to count that or not as law teaching. But and then but I had taken a leave to spend a year at Columbia University, getting my second LLM, this time in environmental law. I'd already had an LLM in from George Washington in international comparative law, and I wanted to do environmental law, which was a brand new field then.
Right.
When I was a law student, there were no courses anywhere in the United States called environmental law. By the time I started teaching, they wanted me to teach environmental law. I figured I should learn something about it. Any event, I had also worked as a lawyer along the way, and one of my jobs, this was 1969-70, I worked with a think tank at George Washington University called the Program for Policy Studies in Science and Technology, as a lawyer and member of an interdisciplinary team doing engaged in a process that's called technology assessment. The specific one, they had a contract from Department of Transportation, I think it was, to analyze if the department, there was a proposal at the time. This was the tail end of the Great Society when big budget items didn't scare Congress much. And so the
not scaring them today either, Professor.
Well, it scares a lot more in Congress today than it used to, than it did back then. All kinds of grand schemes. We were nearing the end. We hadn't quite finished it yet, but we're nearing the end of the multi-billion dollar, which in today's terms would be multi-trillion dollar interstate highway program, building the interstate highway. And the proposal was to build what were called general aviation airports on the same scale that they had built interstate highways. A general aviation airport is an airport where small planes fly in and out, whether they're privately owned or small planes connecting to airlines. And the idea was to build one in just about every town in the country, every city of more than 50,000 people. This was the plan. It was going to be a huge infrastructure project, I say, on the scale of the interstate highways. And so we were contracted to give them an analysis of what would be the social and economic impacts if they did that. How would it change the country? And I was the lawyer member of the team whose job was to analyze what laws would have to be changed, besides the budget, obviously, to make this possible. And how would we, you know, if we had to change the laws, what would be the most desirable way to change them? This is a very long introduction into saying that this experience attuned to me, if you will, made me attuned to asking what is the relevant technologies that were involved in a particular process or event, and how, if at all, did those technologies impact on the process or event. And so it was with that background that I read first time Roe v. Wade after the day it two after it was made public. And it seemed to me that that was precisely the question that was missing from Roe v. Wade, which is there was an attempt. I mean, it wasn't a very good attempt, but there was an attempt to develop a history of abortion in the common law world. It actually took about half of the whole opinion was devoted to history. And what was missing from that history was how did they do abortions at different times? And if the law said this in 1200 or 1400 or in 1600s, you know, how did that reflect the way they did abortions at those times? Because technology of doing
abortions. Are you comfortable? Can you stop for just a second and give just a very thumbnail sketch of what the common law is and how that differs from other statutory law and others?
Well, a common law, of course, is the law of precedent. The law, in other words, created by judicial decisions. Judges make decisions, and in our system, that's considered to be a kind of lawmaking in the sense that the precedent is obligatory on later judges. They have to make their decisions consistent with the precedent, that is, the earlier decisions, unless there's some valid legal reason for departing. And in the United States, the reasons for departing from precedent are actually broader than they would be in England. England has a stricter rule of precedent than we do. And so when we say common law, I basically mean English-speaking countries, because which follow, most of which, there are some exceptions, Scotland is one, but most of which follow the common law system, which not only includes a judge-made law, but statutes that many of which are derived from English statutes and so on and so forth. So that when you talk about American legal history, it is a branch of English legal history. And until the American Revolution, at least, it was practically the same trunk, if you will, of English law. After the American Revolution, we began slowly at first to deviate, but we are still in many respects closely related to English law. There are differences, and the differences keep growing, but
I think sketch out for people by just, and I'm only going to do this once, read right from your amicus brief. And for people who don't know, this is a brief that that people can submit to the Supreme Court to discuss and hopefully aid the justices' considerations of a case that's before them. And this is typically done in the higher profile cases or the more impactful cases. So anytime we see gun control or abortion or some hot button issue, we see a lot of amicus briefs filed and Professor Della Penna has filed an amicus brief in this case. And I'm just going to read the intro paragraph of the summary of the argument, which I think will help because it's well written and I think also digestible for a general audience. You say the majority in Roe v. Wade, influenced by deliberately distorted presentations of the history of abortion laws that have also been pressed upon the court in subsequent cases, erroneously concluded that abortion was not a common law crime. Instead, the historical record shows that A, abortion and other killings of unwanted children were condemned by all respected legal authorities in England from the start of the common law, and B, those laws were applied with full rigor in the United States during the colonial era and into the 19th and 20th centuries, including when the 14th Amendment was adopted. So yeah. I understand that you place a lot of weight on the fact that, according to your assertion, the Supreme Court got it wrong in Roe when they assessed what the common law was, in part due to malfeasance by at least one attorney on the other side and some other reasons as well. So my question for you is, let's say if I were a justice on the Supreme Court, I took it that you're correct, Professor Della Penna, that they got the common law wrong then. Mm-hmm. Does that demand that a sitting justice in 2021? And so, you know, we should probably caption the case for people. It's Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health. And the question presented, just so people have it, this is the case that could overturn Roe v. Wade. And that's my opinion, not yours. So you can tell me if you agree.
My guess is it might severely limit it. I don't think they're going to throw it out completely, but who knows?
The question is whether all pre-viability prohibitions on elective abortions are unconstitutional.
So, that is right.
So if I'm a sitting justice,
if I could,
please.
Could summarize very briefly, and in any brief summary, there's a lot of nuances left out. But very briefly, the argument, it was made to the court in 1971 and 72, because Roe was argued twice, as you may recall. And it was made, by the way, this argument was made by a lawyer who had a memo in her hand before she prepared her arguments, saying that the history she was espousing was false. But she ignored that memo, went ahead and espoused. The argument is that abortion was not a crime. This is why the argument, the discussion of whether it was a crime is relevant, until after the 14th Amendment was adopted, which is patently false, but beside the point. This is the argument. Abortion was not a crime in the common law world, whether you're talking about common law crime, which we had for a long time before the codification of the criminal law in the 19th century. And it was not a statutory crime until after the 14th Amendment. So that when the Constitution itself was written and adopted, when the Bill of Rights was adopted, and when the 14th Amendment was adopted, now it's technically Roe was decided under the 14th Amendment, declared state laws prohibiting abortion violated.
Which was passed in what you have the year of
1868.
Okay.
1868. And depending on which Supreme Court case you look at, you get different versions about which part of the 14th Amendment it violates. Maybe it violates the Due Process Clause. Maybe it violates the Liberty Clause. Some scholars, I don't know. Casey case in 1992 kind of skirted around it, but kind of pointed towards the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. All of those are in the 14th Amendment. But whichever clause you think is the right clause, the argument would be it was not illegal. Therefore, they conclude it was a liberty protected by the under the law until after the 14th Amendment was ratified. And so then if that is a true claim, it's not, but if it is a true claim, then the argument is that you have violated the original meaning of the 14th Amendment by allowing it to be made a crime now. You've taken away someone's freedom, someone's liberty, and so on, because they used to have that liberty and it was protected liberty when the 14th Amendment was adopted, ratified, came into effect. And
these are the penumbras from which the emanations come from, right?
No. Well, in a sense, I mean, they just say, you know, the word liberty, all of those phrases, due process, liberty, equal protection. One could even throw in, although I don't know anyone's brought this up in the abortion context, you could even throw in the privileges and immunities clause. Those are all very open-ended words.
Right.
They don't have any self-evident meaning. And so somehow the court has to interpret what did they mean if they're going to take an originalist position. That is, what is the original meaning of these words in the Constitution? The court has to define what it means. And one way of defining what it means is, if it were true, you see, which it is not, would be to say, look, this was a freedom that women had in 1868, and Congress or the state legislatures don't have the authority to violate those freedoms because the 14th Amendment protect your freedom and my freedom and everyone else's freedom. That's the argument in a nutshell. The problem is that it's based on a completely false history. Abortion was always a crime. It was not a very common crime, but it was always a crime. And the crime was homicide. It was that you were, if you were, and it was abort, generally speaking, you can find an occasional case where a woman herself was charged with murder because of self-abortion, but those are very rare in the record. But, you know, you have cases where the abortionist was charged, he or she, and it could be either, and you find examples of both in the historical record, he or she was charged with homicide. And
I noticed I noted that in your brief you mentioned, I'm looking for it now, in Pennsylvania, there was an early law. That's the only state I'm barred in. So I always, the ears always perk right, up when right. I see it mentioned. But you do go back, in 1850, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court held that the common law supported an action for abortion and said that the moment the womb is instinct with embryo life and the gestation has begun, the crime may be perpetrated. So that's 1850 in Pennsylvania, for instance.
Well, you know, as I said, American legal history, certainly before the revolution, is English legal history. If you go back in England, now I didn't do all the research. I did some of this research myself. And other people were very generous in sharing when they found cases and statutes and ordinances and what have you, very generous in sharing them with me. So I didn't do all of it myself. But if you go back and dig into English legal records, and England has the most complete legal records in the world going back 800 years. We find the very first abortion case we find is in the year 1200. And a number of other cases in the 1200s. And at least one of those, off the top of my head, I can't recall which one, but at least one of those, the court indicates that the woman was 1 month pregnant at the time of this abortion and homicide. Now, she did not die. So the charge of homicide cannot refer to the mother. I mean, there's a series of briefs presented to the Supreme Court.
No, I understand. So just to clarify, you're saying that it has nothing to do with the death of the mother. It is the death of the fetus, and that's why it's
important. It is the death of the fetus. And that 1 month is important. Because it certainly was before viability, and it was certainly before quickening, because that's the way they try to escape today. They sound say, well, not a crime before quickening, and quickening doesn't happen until the 25th week. That, by the way, is also not true. Quickening is when the mother feels the baby move in her womb, first time. That's when the baby
quickens. And typically, do you typically know what week of gestation that occurs in?
It varies with the mother because it varies with the physical condition of the mother, but also varies with the knowledge and experience of the mother. Mother will recognize, mother might say, I've got an upset tummy or I've got butterflies. But with a first pregnancy, after she's been pregnant and has a second or third or fourth pregnancy, might say, oh, the baby's moving, you see. So, I mean, it's not a hard and fast line, but it's certainly well before 25 weeks. The reason the historian's brief comes up and says it's 25 weeks, and says that's a medical consensus, which is a flat out lie. The reason they say that, of course, is that is the point where they want to draw the line at the end of the second trimester. If you're going to allow any kind of restrictions on abortion, they want it only in the third trimester. They would love to have no restrictions on abortion until the umbilical cord is cut. If they could,
well, also after,
but they've given up on that one.
So, as I understand the law presently, in the Casey environment, it's sort of a hybrid system with trimesters and viability, where generally speaking, first trimester abortions are prohibited. Generally speaking,
it just doesn't bother you that I'm drinking water.
No, please. Generally speaking, first trimester provisions are prohibited. Generally speaking, first trimester abortions are widely permitted. Third trimester abortions are able to have many legal barriers put in place for them. And then it's a mixed bag for the second trimester. Is that a fair understanding of the law presently?
No, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I mean, as it's expressed with not where it should be, but as
No. Okay. I don't think that's where the law is. I don't think it's ever been there. I think Justice Blackmun, when he wrote his opinion, whether he did it consciously to deceive or not, I don't know. I never met the man. I know a lot of people who have, but I never have. Justice Blackmun set up a formula of words that seemed to create a progressively more restrictive environment. But if you analyze carefully what he said, there were no meaningful restrictions on abortion before Casey, before the Casey decision. But Roe v. Wade was 1973. Casey versus Planned Parenthood of Southeast Pennsylvania was 1992. During that 19-year period, there were no legal restrictions whatsoever. What Blackmun said is the state can impose no restrictions at all in the first trimester, the first 13 weeks. The second trimester, from the 13th week to the 26th week, the state can only impose restrictions for the protection of the mother. And the Supreme Court in subsequent cases made clear that the only restriction that they could impose necessary to protect the mother is to require that an abortion be done by a qualified doctor. No other restrictions allowed. And that's really no restriction at all. Be very foolish. Once you have legal access to a qualified doctor, be very foolish.
And there are certainly permissive doctors who would abort in any instance, basically.
That's right. Now, the third trimester, from 26th to the 39th week, he said the state can impose restrictions for the protection of the child so long as it does not affect the mother's health. And the court made it clear that health included mental health. Once you say that, there's no meaningful restriction in the third trimester because the only person who decides her mental health would be adversely affected is the doctor doing the abortion. Does not have to consult with a psychiatrist or even an independent second opinion from another doctor. Makes his own decision. And affecting her mental health might not be anything more than she's unhappy being pregnant.
Right.
You see, once you say that, there's no meaningful restriction under Roe v. Wade. Now, Casey said that you can impose restrictions if they don't impose what's called an undue burden on access to abortion.
That includes, so we've had states that have tried to include ultrasounds, intrauterine detected
waiting
pregnancy
periods,
tests, all sorts of things that have been held
Most of them were held to be undue burdens.
Right.
Right. Mostly by lower courts, but nonetheless, most of them were held to be undue burdens. So there's very little, if any, real restriction throughout the 9 months of pregnancy. If you carefully analyze the language of the cases, I wrote an op-ed piece right after Casey's decided and said, all right, well, let's think of something that would be an undue burden. Why not prohibit, and this, I didn't use the phrase because it hadn't been invented yet, but in effect, I said, why not prohibit partial birth abortions? This happens mostly in the third trimester when the techniques that are available in the first and second trimester are pretty effective without disturbing its position in the womb. But in the third trimester, your child is so large that the most practical way to do an abortion is to allow it to be born.
We're gonna just skip past the kind of more graphic discussion of that procedure, just because it's a general audience show that.
Okay. All know, right. Well, in any event, you kill the baby when it's partially born. Yes. You kill it after it's partially born. It's actually, it's typically a baby is born head first, and its head is actually outside of the womb, outside of the mother, really, when you kill it. But it's not fully born. And this, the pretense is because it's not fully born, it's still an abortion and not an infanticide. Why is delivering a live baby, if you can deliver it live and it can right. survive, why is that an undue burden on the mother, especially if she's not required to take care of it? That was my question.
That to me is the most indefensible for anybody of the various abortion procedures that are known. So I think that's probably the easiest one for people to agree that it should be outlawed and not allowed. But I want to take it back to the first trimester, to that first mm-hmm. month. You know, I always thought when I was looking at this issue as a law student and after, that technology would be the thing that dialed back the date when an abortion would be allowed, only because the vagueness as to when viability or personhood attached to the fetus would be reduced by technology. And it seems like we're headed to a point where very soon after conception in the future, we're going to have the ability for a fetus to survive outside the mother. But for now, anyway, for that first month, let's say, for the zygote that doesn't have a human form, let's say, what is the legal reason why, besides the common law, which you've established is, you know, you think is an important reason for them to say that it's allowable for that to be made
That's
illegal.
What they say. I don't say that. I think the common law makes clear that the state has the power to prohibit abortion if it chooses. I mean, some states, if you left it up to the states, some states would make abortion legal through part of the pregnancy. Other states would make abortion legal throughout pregnancy. Other states would make it illegal throughout pregnancy.
One thing that I've thought, and I haven't seen much discussed about this, is that the Supreme Court could say that there is no legal abortion because personhood exists in the person of the fetus at a certain stage, and that fetus has the right to not be killed during the course of an abortion, and therefore that abortion is federally illegal after week X. Do you agree that that's a possible, not likely outcome, but that's a possible outcome?
I think it's possible outcome. I don't think the Supreme Court's going to go down that road.
Yeah, they're not going to.
No decision has gotten them more grief, more criticism in their entire history than Roe v. Wade. I mean, that includes the Dred Scott about slavery. That includes Plessy versus Ferguson against separate but equal. No decision has gotten them more criticism, more grief than Roe v. Wade. I think if they overrule in whole or in part Roe v. Wade, that it's their way of washing their hands of it, saying, we're not going to be involved in this anymore. You do what you want, states. It's not up to us anymore.
In preparation for speaking to you today, I listened to the oral argument for the re-argument of Roe, and you mentioned it earlier, and I'll just so people understand, when the court initially heard Roe versus Wade, it was a 7-member panel. Justice Rehnquist and Potter, maybe, were not on the court, and they had been appointed. And
yeah.
And so the court, when, you know, it's a rare thing, but not, you know, it's not unheard of, but it just typically cases are not re-argued. So what happens is if a court hears the case and then doesn't issue an opinion before they break in the summertime, they'll often hear, they'll hear a re-argument of the case. And that's what happened in Roe before the 9-member panel, which then voted, you know, that it was OK. But they said during the argument that at the time there were some states that said abortion was banned except for the life of the mother, and then some states had it banned except for the health of the mother. But it was kind of nebulous as to what that meant in terms of health-wise. Would it be very expansive, like you've just discussed, with mental health, for instance, or was there a more exacting standard that would have to be met?
And some states, because the abortion, so-called abortion reform movement had been gathering steam, some states had what's called an indications policy. You can have an abortion for certain reasons, rape, incest, defect, deformity of the baby, certain indications. And then two states, New York and Hawaii, had legalized abortion up to 20 or 24 weeks, flat out, no restrictions at all. But none of them was it for the whole 9 months of pregnancy.
If you were a Supreme Court justice, what would you rule on Dobbs?
Well, I personally would say that Roe was decided incorrectly and that this is not a constitutional issue. I would throw it back to the states.
And then
because I'm not braver than the actual Supreme Court justice.
right. And then the states would be permitted the full breadth of very little restriction on abortion to massive, you know, presumably banned for you know, in Oklahoma, yeah, and other conservative states, there'd be no legal abortion.
And that raises another question, which I wrote a law review article on, by the way, is can you enforce the law on your citizens if they go out of state for an abortion?
What do you think?
Can you prosecute them when they come back? I think you can, but you know, I'm not sure the Supreme Court would agree with that.
I remember there was an international case of Ireland trying to prevent a woman from traveling internationally who was going to have an abortion at the time of Roe. In fact, I was listening to Roe, it was like a C-SPAN presentation. They had a law professor from Georgetown, whose name I forget, talking about it. And she mentioned that Roe was, she used the word destitute, but a poor woman who couldn't travel to New York or another place, couldn't afford to travel to New York or another place to have an abortion. That's why they sued. And I just thought, just my cynical sense of humor, like, well, it's certainly cheaper to travel to New York than to bring a case up through the federal courts to reach the Supreme Court.
But, she didn't have to pay for that.
Yeah, for sure.
No, it's a, you know, if you read Norma McCorvey, who is Jane Roe,
right? Who, by the way, for the record, I'll just interrupt and say, who opposes legal access to abortion by and large and thinks it was a mistake for her to abort. Anyway,
yeah, she was a poor woman. She had two illegitimate children. I believe it was two already. She didn't want a third one. She wanted an abortion. She went to a so-called women's collective in Dallas, or was it Houston? Dallas, because it was the prosecuting attorney for Dallas. Wade was the prosecuting attorney for Dallas. So it had to be in Dallas. She went to this so-called women's collective in Dallas seeking an abortion. She did not seek a lawsuit. And they grabbed her and said, we're going to make you plaintiff. Go to the court.
Right.
And there's a lot of, and by the time Roe was decided, she'd already given birth and she kept the baby and raised it. And so one of the preliminary issues that is discussed in her opinion is whether the case is moot because this woman's already given birth. She can't have an abortion now, even if she wins the case. But the behavior of this group, this women's group, including Sarah Weddington, who is a hero to the abortion rights movement, because she was the young woman, young attorney, 27, 28, when she argued Roe before the Supreme Court and won. Her behavior raises a lot of serious ethical questions about, because a lawyer is supposed to put the interests of the client first. She and the other women that she was collaborating with, Norma McCorvey came and asked them, can you help me arrange an abortion? And they said no, even though Sarah Weddington herself had an illegal abortion, she knew very well how to arrange it, and she could have arranged for Norma McCorvey to go to Mexico. I mean, if the women's collective really wanted to help her, they could have chipped in some money, sent her to Mexico, where she could get probably an illegal abortion, but with no legal risk whatsoever. She got it in Texas, which is what I think, if my memory is correct, is what Sarah Weddington did. But, you know, there's some legal risk if she gets it in Texas, because Texas had not only was it illegal, but there were some efforts to enforce that law.
In terms of attorney malfeasance, you also mentioned by name Cyril Means Jr., the NARAL, National Abortion Rights Action League, which I think changed its name to some other thing that doesn't have the word abortion in it, because it's displeasing to the public to think about it that way.
Well, it was a national, at first it was called the National Abortion, National Association of Reform of Abortion Laws. Then they changed their name after they got some of these abortion laws reformed, meaning more permissive laws enacted. Then they changed their name, National Abortion Rights Action League. And now, technically, their name is NARAL Pro-Choice America.
Ah, yes. Pro-choice.
And narrow, they don't define what narrow sure. stands for, but you can take either National Association for the Reform of Abortion Laws, or you can take National.
It's like when Kentucky Fried Action. Chicken took the fried out of the, now they're just
right,
KFC.
KFC, right? Yeah. So they've changed their name, but it's the same organization. Cyril Means, a law professor at New York Law School in, not New York University, New York Law School, a private, unaffiliated law school in New York City. Was at the time general counsel of NARO. It is his job to represent NARO's interests.
Right.
He was also appointed by Governor Rockefeller to a commission to study reform of abortion laws in New York State, which eventually enacted a law that said in 1970, it said abortion was legal for, I think it was 24 weeks without any restrictions whatsoever. And it passed, by the way, that law passed by one vote in the state legislature. So he was helped draft that law. And in the course of working on that commission and working as general counsel for NARO, he said, maybe if I can come up with an explanation to show that this is consistent with the best traditions of the common law of American legal history and so on, that'll make it easier to pass these changes. And so he wrote two very long, each one's over 100 pages, law review articles of purely spurious history.
This is, what did you call it? The imagined, what's it called? There was a term the lost voices. Is that?
That's another theory. That was not his theory. That's what some modern feminist historians say. Well, we have to recover the lost voices of women from prior centuries to get a true picture of the history.
Which is the history they wish were written rather than the one that was?
Well, there's nothing written from them for the most part. I mean, the fact of the matter, most of the written records we have, almost all of them, are written by men. And the things we have that are written by women, for the most part, don't mention abortion one way or the other. They're silent on it. Well, I mean, what does that mean?
If you're a feminist, it means that there's a heteronormative patriarchy that prevented those women's voices from being recorded at the time, right?
Yeah, but what were those voices? What did they think? The best example we have of what they mean is from the leaders of the women's movement in the 19th century, the suffragist movement. The women who met at, Saratoga in New York in 1848.
Elizabeth Cady Stanton.
For women's suffrage on through the 19th and early 20th century. They are unanimous in supporting laws prohibiting abortion.
Did they discuss it from a feminist perspective?
They discussed it, and from the feminist perspective, they saw abortion as something that's forced on unwilling women by men. Men don't want the responsibility. They force their girlfriends or their wives to have abortions, and that shouldn't happen.
And that's before the modern support laws that require men to, give up so much of their income.
Well, maybe. I think there were support laws, but, try to enforce them in 1850. If I'm a man and I don't want to have to pay support, all I have to do is hitch up my horse and, go 100 miles down the road and nobody will ever find me. It's a lot harder to disappear today than it was then. You have social security numbers for one thing, and it's hard to get to create a new identity.
Absolutely. Let's circle back around if we could. You mentioned the traveling, and that reminds me that I don't think I allowed you to give me a clear answer to the question of prosecuting, if there is that person who lives in Oklahoma who has who's pregnant, and then they say, okay, I'm going to travel to California or New York and get an abortion. If the Supreme Court were to send it to the states, can Oklahoma prosecute that woman for whatever homicide or some other violation of the law if it's illegal in Oklahoma for leaving the state?
Historically, if you go back 100 years, 500 years, 800 years, at least in the common law world, almost no evidence. There's a rare case here or there, but almost no evidence of ever prosecuting the woman who has the abortion for a crime. Okay. She's traditionally, now this may not be realistic in today's world, but traditionally she was viewed as a victim of the crime.
And also, right, another victim.
And, the abortionist and anyone who pressured her to get an abortion was prosecuted.
Okay.
But not the woman herself. And to understand why that tradition arose, You have to understand how abortions were done. Now there are, you can, lots of different techniques. And I did a lot of original research on this, as well as looking at what other people have found. But you can group them into three broad categories. One is what I call injury techniques. You physically injure a pregnant woman to the point that she cannot continue the pregnancy. Now, this often
I say this, mean, you know, the kick somebody down a flight of stairs sort of method, if you will.
That sort of thing. Right. Hit her with a baseball bat or its equivalent in the Middle Ages on the stomach, things like that. Never plan. I doubt very many women volunteered for that.
Right.
Now, the second option is what I call ingestion techniques. Take a potion, and that's the word that was used in the early laws.
Some concoction of herbs or whatever that may induce
an abortion. Right. It turns out that most of what we learned about down through the centuries about poisons, things like arsenic and cyanide, were discovered in the search for effective abortifacient potions. These potions, when they work, only worked by weakening the woman's health generally. Not sure. They were not.
It's like a chemotherapy solution almost kills you. Yeah, okay.
Almost kills you or did kill you.
Right.
and there have been, and so what you find in the records are women who were killed or seriously injured, nearly killed, in order by someone coercing her into an abortion. What you also find in the record, you find no evidence of voluntary abortions until about 1730, 1740. Find no evidence at all. And then what you do find in the record, where women and women were charged with murder, is infanticide, killing the newborn. I mean, women who were determined not to have a child they didn't want. They might try an abortion, but when it failed and they knew that the next step, if they wanted to continue trying,
they smother the baby, basically. Yeah.
They'll wait until it's born and then they'll dispose of it, or they'll ask the midwife to dispose of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the earliest abortion regulations we find are regulations of midwives, not telling them don't abort, telling them don't kill the baby.
Right.
Making clear they know that's a crime.
Yeah, I think in modern parlance, you know, there's going to be, I mean, I could see it now, the elected prosecutors and boy, in the face of the Rittenhouse prosecution, my opinion of prosecutors is at a new low. I don't know if you've been paying much attention there, but we can save that for another day. But in any case, there are going to be prosecutors, we can all agree, that will, if the law allows it at all, that will prosecute a woman for attempting to abort or looking to abort. Do you think that the vision, that the founders' vision, coupled with the 14th Amendment, would allow, you know, for that, if they wanted to go to a different jurisdiction to abort? Could that Oklahoma woman go to California and have an abortion without?
Well, again, the question is, do you prosecute the woman or do you prosecute the woman, the people who facilitate it?
American Airlines?
There actually was a case in Pennsylvania that raised this question directly. And of course, if you're a certain view of abortion, you think this case is outrageous. And if you have a different view of abortion, you think it's the minimum that should have been done. Young man, early 20s, I forget his exact age, gets a 14-year-old girl pregnant. Now, she... too young to get an abortion in Pennsylvania without permission from her parents.
Or a judge, right?
Or a judge. Right. She could go before a judge. She don't want to do that. He's pressing her to have an abortion. He doesn't want to marry her. He don't want to be stuck with a child bride. And whether she wanted an abortion or whether she's just reacting to his pressure, I can't say, but she agrees. He drives her to New Jersey, where doctor's willing to do the abortion without permission from her mother or a judge. And she has an abortion, and he drives her home. Actually, it's even more dramatic than that. His mother, not her mother, his mother drives her to New Jersey and then drives her back. And the prosecutor brought charges and convicted the mother and son of criminal abortion because they did not have the permission of the mother, even though the abortion took place in New Jersey where it was legal. And as I say, depending on your view of abortion, you either see this as outrageous right. or the minimum you could do.
Well, I'm always struck by laws where and I generally favor legalized access to abortion. As I'm a libertarian, and any imposition in the state on mm-hmm. on individual affairs, I tend to oppose as a reflex. But I'm also mindful that if we prohibit 14-year-olds from getting tattoos or piercing their ears because they can't exercise yeah. good judgment on that front, maybe we ought to have some indication on abortion that doesn't treat them like they're 30 years old. And the judgment that they, you know, would offer. So at a minimum.
Well, I mean, you want to see the ultimate contradiction in our, shall we say, reproductive politics. The 14-year-old in just about every state in the United States, there might be one in the South where the age is that low, but in the United States, you cannot consent to sex.
Sure.
But if the abortion rights people have their way, she can consent to abortion. And, yeah. and the same people who support her right to consent to an abortion support the law that says she cannot consent to sex. The mother's excuse, defense, if you will, in that Pennsylvania prosecution, why she went to such lengths to have the abortion is because her son.
Right. It's evidence of the crime.
Statutory rape.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
Destroying the evidence of the crime.
Yeah. And so, I mean, she can't consent to sex, although, in fact, 14-year-olds sometimes do, right? But nonetheless, legally, she can't, and that can be prosecuted. But she can consent if you take a certain view of abortion rights to abortion. Does that make sense?
The hypocrisy abounds. What do you expect to come from, you know, we have Justice Barrett now, we have Kavanaugh. I think Gorsuch is, well, I'll let you answer. What do you think? What do you expect from the court? It was 7-2 for Roe. Yeah. And
I think they'll severely limit Roe. It's possible to overrule it completely. My guess would be, who knows? I mean, Kavanaugh pledged.
A Catholic,
publicly.
By the way, I think it's important to note.
I mean, there's 6 out of the 9 justices. Yeah. Like that. Well, I mean, this is an interesting transition or transformation of the Supreme Court. Until sometime in the 20th century, I think it. Lucius Quintus Lamar in the late 19th century was our first Catholic Supreme Court justice. But until the 1980s, at least, I'd have to go back and check precise records. We never had more than one Catholic on the Supreme Court. We got our first Jew on the Supreme Court in 1916. That was Louis Brandeis. And we always had what we called the Catholic seat, and we had what we called the Jewish right. seat. So when the Jewish member of the court died or retired, new Jewish member was appointed, new Catholic to replace the old Catholic. And then suddenly, I think it was under Ronald Reagan, this changed. Not all of his appointments were Catholics or Jews, but we now have a Supreme Court which has 6 Catholics and 3 Jews.
A legalistic religion is just bound to produce more justices than one that's not. This is the thing that people, you know, it has nothing to do with anything other than that. I think, you know, when you're raised Catholic or Jewish, you know, you get out of things because you can artfully argue certain things, and that just naturally, you know, bubbles up.
We managed to survive roughly the first 200 years with a predominantly Protestant Supreme Court. We have no Protestants on it at all, period. My explanation is more cynical than that. I think the Republican presidents were the ones who have appointed the Catholics. One of the things every president fears, I appoint someone and he or she is supposed to agree with my political views and they betray me. They go the other way. And it happens in both directions, although since so many of the Supreme Court justices have been appointed by Republicans, we notice it more with them, but it happens the other way too. Catholics are more reliably conservative than Protestants. You appoint one, he or she is less likely to drift away
Got it.
And Jews are more reliably liberal. So the Democrats appoint Jews and they're less likely to drift away. That's a more cynical view than just say they're legalistic.
Right. Well, maybe both are at play.
Yeah, but we have six Catholics, three Jews on the court. It's an interesting phenomenon. If they were confronted with the claims of Roe v. Wade with no precedent, I think the clear majority would say no constitutional right, period. I think some of them will shy away from going that far. Kavanaugh, now the question is, you know, how much you will feel bound by this. But Kavanaugh publicly stated during the hearings, I think it was Susan Collin who asked him, will you pledge not to overrule Roe v. Wade? And he said, yes, I will pledge not to overrule Roe v. Wade. Now, if he feels bound by that, he's not going to vote to overrule Roe v. Wade. But he didn't. And some of the others might feel as a matter of practical politics. You see, the political stature of the court will suffer if we outright overrule Roe v. Wade. So they might say, let's do it a step at a time.
You know, before
law school, do it in one big decision. And so if that's true, I might be wrong. I mean, we'll find out by next June. That's when they issue most. The decision could come earlier than next June, but it's almost certainly going to come by next June when the court turns its term. If I'm right or wrong about this, but my guess is they'll issue a decision that severely limits Roe, but doesn't technically overrule it. There's still something left of it.
I worked for a constitutional scholar who I will not name because of what I'm about to say, but this is a person who could have been now will be aged out and not never be considered for the Supreme Court, but they could have been on the court. And they said that, you know, if you're before that Senate panel, it's like the East German border guards, you know, are you going to tell the truth or not when you, you know, you craft your answer in a way that that allows you to not lie, but also maybe deliver an impression that isn't necessarily the whole truth.
Well, I agree. But I mean, you know, he did say, I won't vote to overrule Roe. And that's a public commitment. Now, you know, you can say, I changed my mind. But
yeah, you can't take that. What do you do if you're a senator and you got that answer? You can't. There's no bureau to go to say, you know, here's my receipt. Here's my guarantee.
No, that's right. That's right.
If it's done, it's done.
So my guess is some will want to overrule. Some justices want to. So the liberal three will want to keep Roe, strengthen Roe. Actually, some justices out of the conservative six will say overrule it completely, and a group in the middle, drawn from the conservative six, will say, well, we don't have to overrule it. To decide this case, we don't have to overrule it here. We can decide this that allows this statute, but does not directly overrule Roe.
I'm going to call you for comment when the ruling comes out. And in the meantime, I hope you stay well. And thank you so much for joining us on this uprising. And
all right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor.
Okay.
Bye-bye. That's it for this edition of The Uprising. Remember to hit Liberty Nation News for original articles, LN Radio, and our signature television program, The Conservative Five. Just go to LibertyNation.com on your browser or hit Rumble, YouTube, or check out our Liberty Nation News Roku channel. I'm Scott Cosenza. Thanks for listening or watching. This program is a production of LibertyNation.com, conservative news where truth matters.
Who are we? We are Americans that believe in liberty. We are a project of the nonprofit, One Generation Away. We are patriots who apply the founding principles to the issues of today.
And they keep moving the goalposts on us.
We are educators and commentators who love America and the Constitution. Who are we? We are Liberty Nation.